It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A public health researcher at the University of Michigan paints a picture of what deportation looks like, not at the U.S.-Mexico border, but in quiet, predominantly white, rural parts of the Midwest, places including Wisconsin.
William Lopez has spent half of his life in Latino communities growing up in South Texas and half of his life in mostly white Midwest communities.
His new book highlights places where worksite immigration raids occurred in the Midwest, starting in 2008 in Postville, Iowa, and hearing firsthand how raids affected families and residents.
His new book is called Raiding the Heartland, an American story of deportation and resistance. Bill, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Some of the people you interviewed described the experience of worksite raids as singular, unexpected, and devastating. What did they compare a raid to help convey this trauma?
Yeah, as we spoke with folks throughout the country about the raids that their communities experienced, it was often as though they were trying to find the words to explain what it was like as they were answering the question. I'll remind folks that the worksite raids we studied and the sites we visited were very typical locations for worksite raids, rural areas, generally tending to be in what we call the heartland of the U.S. And folks began often with comparisons of disasters they knew. There were folks who compared them to tornadoes, saying that a raid is like a tornado. It can take out a section of the town. But these comparisons to natural disaster sometimes felt a little empty, or like they were lacking some other element of raids. And one of the elements that it lacked was actually violence. So folks often extended the comparison from something like a tornado to a situation of violence that involved people. We heard a lot of, for example, comparisons to school shootings. We heard comparisons to 9/11 and to the Challenger explosion, as in not only were they devastating with loss of life or at least harm, but they sat in the community's memory, right? It shaped the way the community remembered their lives and that day and how they went about the rest of their lives after that point.
You describe these worksite raids as particularly violent method of immigration enforcement. Can you talk further about that? What is it about these moments that are so violent?
Sure. And, you know, Kate, to understand the full impact of these raids, we kind of have to think about also where they happen. Mm-hmm. And these worksite raids are in places that are generally small, quiet, isolated. And all of the sudden, right, with the force of an organized hurricane, hundreds of agents will descend upon these towns. Throughout interview after interview, we had people referencing the helicopters that were buzzing overhead. Now, why would they mention helicopters? Because it's just so rare. The only time anyone would ever see a helicopter is perhaps one of the helicopters associated with the university hospital, right? And even that doesn't really happen in small towns. In addition to hundreds of officers, there would be buses, there would be police cars and other enforcement vehicles. And then at the moment of the raid, the officers surround these facilities. You know, they enter into the building, they force everyone to go into the middle of the building, and then they arrest them and walk them out, usually in a long line, as you've seen in photo ops of folks who are handcuffed or shackled, or in many cases, zip tied with their hands behind their backs. And you know, one thing I like to remind people is the threat of being hurt, the threat of being shot, is a constant in people's minds as they're arrested. No one leaves their well-established home and country and family and life and job simply because they're asked politely, right? These people were leaving because, as many folks told me, they were worried about being shot. They were worried about being killed. This is why raids are able to function, because of the military might that's able to, you know, coerce this type of obedience from a large group of people.
You talk with, I think it was Juana, one of the wives, who described white managers sobbing, Latino workers disappearing, Latino wives picking up their husbands' belongings. It sounds devastating.
Okay, that moment with Juana is one I'll never forget. So I was with Juana and her husband. in a small room in a church in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, right? A town very much like other towns throughout the Midwest, throughout the heartland. And rare is a situation in which you're talking with someone who is inside of a rated facility and someone who knows what it's like to have a husband disappear, right? Mm. So I was in this situation where, on the one hand, her husband, Alicio, and these are all pseudonyms, of course, Alicio was telling me I was terrified the moment the ICE agents entered into the facility because I thought I was going to get shot. Juana, on the other hand, was telling me about what it was like to try to figure out what was happening because her son's teacher actually called Juana seeing ICE vehicles outside of the facility and said, I think your husband's in danger. So like so many other people throughout these communities, Juana was trying to put the pieces together of what was going to happen, including how she was going to tell her son or if she was going to, you know, rely on the teacher to do so and try to figure out what was, how to explain what was happening, if what was happening was even in fact finished. Mm. ICE does not say when a raid starts and does not say when a raid ends and does not say if it's going to continue out into the community. So part of the fear of these events is that you never really know if what has happened is done happening or if it's going to continue happening.
You mentioned the teachers, one of the big groups of people who are dealing with the aftermath of raids are the teachers of these children. What role do they have in communities after worksite raids and the deportations?
You know, what I've come to understand is that aside from immigrant families themselves, teachers will bear the brunt of mass deportation. And I say that because when I studied worksite raids and started to understand the mechanics of when they happen, worksite raids happen during the workday. And with few exceptions, during the workday, we know where children and teenagers are going to be. They're going to be at school. And sometimes they're within visible distance of these factories that their parents worked at. Other times, especially in high school, students may learn about their parents' detentions on the phone, on Facebook, right, on Instagram, mm-hmm. or whatever they're using. And usually it's the teachers who have to explain to those students what's happening and explain to the students that the parents who dropped them off may not be the parents that picked them up that day. And I say this both because the day of the raid, there's so much scrambling by teachers and administrators to figure out what to do. Just to give one more example, we visited a school in Morristown, which is right outside of Bean Station, Tennessee, where a meatpacking plant was raided. And the principal and administrators had to figure out how to tell their bus drivers, there may not be parents home when you drop the kids off. So you need to make sure that their students go into houses that are not empty. And those teachers, like others we met in Texas, actually packed lunches for their students who stopped coming to school and hand-delivered those lunches to those student homes. And I'll just to carry on with one more point here, Kate, we see not only teachers responding the day of, but what happens is just a large amount of absences in the days that follow. And when students can't go to school, grades drop, they don't pass. And what's easy to miss is a lot of times they simply don't eat. There's lots of students eating in the cafeteria. So teachers not only had to counsel students, they had to figure out how to address the absentee and grade a gap that developed. And for teachers who particularly cared about their students, they had to figure out how to feed them. I'll never forget a principal in Bean Station who told me that, you know, teachers take care of the full student. And she said, in the South, you can't just let people go hungry.
Mm. We're talking with Bill Lopez, clinical associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. His new book is called Raiding the Heartland, and it investigates worksite immigration raids by ICE agents in rural Midwestern towns and the impact that these raids have on families and the larger community. Bill, you know, your book also centers around a worksite raid in Postville, Iowa in 2008. This is roughly 25 miles from Prairie du Chien near the Wisconsin border. Nearly 400 people were taken by ICE, about a third of Postville's population at the time. Why is this raid so unprecedented?
the postco raid was historic for many reasons, and the most obvious of which is just how many people were taken, right? Though we do see more people were taken recently in the raid in Ellabelle, Georgia of the Hyundai plant. So as true to this administration's pattern, they continue to break immigration enforcement records. The postco raid was important for a few reasons. As I argue in the book, immigration enforcement is always about telling a story. Particular politicians will choose specific strategies to tell the story that they want to tell. An obvious example is the wall, right? We see during the first Trump administration, the focus was on building this wall because he wanted to tell this story of quote unquote mass invasion from the South, right? Immigration raids, especially worksite raids, also tell a story. The postco was important because during the time President Bush was losing some of his appeal following, for example, Hurricane Katrina. And what he wanted to do was show that he was in control of a large military force. And this is perhaps ironic, was considerate to individual undocumented immigrants, but not necessarily considerate of their employers, meaning he wanted to focus enforcement on the employers. So he conducted these large worksite raids. But what we saw happened after them was just enormous humanitarian fallout. One of the comparisons I write about in the book was that detainees were housed in a cattle processing facility, were marched up and down in a way that cattle were, and reporters continued to talk about this as cattle processing. So what ended up happening is that President Bush kind of lost control of the narrative, and what was meant to be a show of military might became a show of a lack of humanitarian compassion for immigrants. And one of the reasons that this is so important is because President Bush and then President Obama wanted to work on immigration policy changes across both sides of the aisle. And to do that, they had to choose carefully their enforcement patterns or enforcement tactics and keep in mind these humanitarian issues, right? President Obama stopped conducting large-scale worksite raids, as did President Biden, not to say that they didn't deport others in different ways, but they did not conduct it these type of raids because of their humanitarian fallout. Now, this changed in the Trump administration, because what the Trump administration realized is this fallout, this chaos and cruelty was exactly the type of immigration enforcement the administration wanted to center. So we see an embrace of these raids in 2018 when 6 raids happened, all of which we visited. And then in 2019, if you recall, the raids in Mississippi, also record-setting raids. As happens, during the winter, these raids slowed down. And then came 2020 during the pandemic, and these raids did not pick up again. But as we predicted, there we're seeing these worksite raids happen again during this administration, most recently the raid in Ellabelle, Georgia, of the Hyundai plant.
There is a detention center under construction at Fort Bliss in Texas. It's called Camp East Montana, and people who have seen the facility, they're calling it a tent city. Washington Post is reporting how it fails to really properly monitor and treat some detainees. And we're seeing other reports that, you know, for weeks, people detained are not having any access to lawyers or their cases. And it did make me think about the cattle auction site at Postville and your book, and how ICE stands up these deportation facilities. How should regulatory agencies approach these detention centers and what they are like?
Kate, one thing that we really see brought to the fore when we think about immigration enforcement is just how little oversight it involves. So immigration enforcement, DHS, right, is all under the purview of the president. And what this means is that there's not local accountability. I had one high-ranking police officer tell me that ICE has no incentive to work with the community. They go in and then they leave. They go in and they arrest people, and they actually don't care if the community turns against law enforcement or any other government services because they have jurisdiction over the whole country. Officers may not live in the area, and there's simply no oversight. We see that more and more with the current administration, that there is just no way to, first of all, identify any ICE agents. We're not seeing badge numbers, and of course, we're seeing faces covered by masks. So even when we have particularly violent acts, like we see recent shattering of windows and removing people from cars, there's just not a clear way to, this sounds silly, but to file a complaint, right? To hold anyone responsible. So going back to your question about detention centers, right? Who has jurisdiction over those? What we easily see is that sometimes it's unclear. Sometimes we don't know. And often when folks do try to investigate, we saw recently in New York City, Democratic electeds were arrested as they tried to investigate a holding cell in New York City, right? In Manhattan, I believe. So we see that these the secrets, the inner workings of these detention centers are protected precisely because there is no oversight anywhere along this command chain.
You say we are in a moment of mass deportation and mass resistance. What do you mean by that?
So, Kate, traveling the country and seeing all of these communities talk about how devastating immigration raids can be, but also spending just as much, if not more, time telling me about their creative responses was just inspiring, right? As I've mentioned before, communities don't just sit by and let their neighbors and family members be removed. Throughout all of history, communities have always done something. Now, some examples I give in the book, among the most immediate responses, hours after raids, churches opened their doors so that folks who were scared to sleep in their homes could sleep in the pews. And I describe this in the book as some kind of loaves and fishes type of miracle. But what would also happen is these churches would become beacons in the community where volunteers would come to provide whatever they could to those who were hiding in the church. This definitely included lawyers who would come to work through people's immigration issues. It also included reporters who would come to tell a fuller story about the raid. And then I'll give one more example. One of the ironies of detention is that sometimes immigrants are released to await their deportation hearings outside of detention, but at the same time are asked to do so many things before they go to detention for their paperwork, right? And this includes checking in places, going to hospital visits, getting passports, et cetera. But most undocumented folks, as we know, don't have driver's licenses. Not all, but in many states, it's still not allowed. So in Ohio, who experienced two once-in-a-lifetime raids, you know, within the same month in Sandusky and in Salem, there was actually a rideshare program that was created. And most of the drivers in that rideshare program were white or retirees, and many didn't speak Spanish. So they just had this combination of factors that was exactly what was needed at the time. And that is, they had a driver's license, they had an app on their phone that would help them translate and the nerve to use it when they could, and they were white. So they wouldn't get racially profiled, as we know from evidence was going on by Border Patrol in Ohio at the time. And these are just a couple of examples of the strategies communities had to address the needs of families that sprung up after raids like this.
Bill, thank you for your book and bringing us closer to these stories.
Okay, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for reading.
Bill Lopez is a clinical associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. His new book is called Raiding the Heartland, an American Story of Deportation and Resistance. Lopez teaches and researches the impacts of immigration and policing in communities of color. We'll be right back.